A school superintendent's shocking retirement in Broward County, a third place experiment in Palm Beach County, and more frustration for Venezuelans everywhere. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the Broward bog down. School Superintendent Peter Licata retires after less than a year on the job, while the district settles in court to pay tens of millions of dollars to charter schools. We'll also look at how West Palm Beach is restoring the idea of public spaces as third places. And we'll examine why the Biden administration had to retighten the oil sanctions screws on Venezuela this week and what it all means for expat voters here. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. The last thing the embattled Broward County Public Schools needed was more bad news. But that's exactly what they got this week when their new superintendent, Peter Licata, announced he's retiring after less than a year on the job for health reasons. The Broward School Board immediately tapped Deputy Superintendent Howard Hepburn to replace Licata. Still, the shocking news simply threw the district into more of the disarray it's been living with for years now. And truth is, Licata's exit is just one piece of unwelcome news for Broward schools this week. The district also announced it's having to settle in court to pay out tens of millions of dollars to the county's charter schools. Licata's sudden retirement also raises questions about a key reform plan called Redefining Our Schools, which involves closing schools amid declining student enrollment. All of this puts more pressure on the declining budget of Florida's second largest school district and America's sixth largest. How do the Broward Public Schools pull out of these chronic problems? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me here in the studio to discuss this Broward bog down is WLRN education reporter Kate Payne. Also joining us is our Broward County reporter, Gerard Albert III. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Tim.
Gerard, I want to start with you because you were at that Broward County School Board meeting this week when Licata announced his retirement. Let's listen first to some of what he said.
After conferring recently with my doctors, my wife, and my four adult children, it is best that I retire from this incredible role.
Gerard, how stunned was the room at that moment?
People were surprised. Licata had pitched himself as the one to transform the school district. It was his dream job. He was coming home. So the room, which was packed because it was a very contentious meeting, was surprised. Other board members, I think, had known about some of his health issues since December,
right,
and
yeah.
Then had found out, I think he had told them separately a couple of days before, but nobody else knew, and the mood had entirely shifted after that announcement. It was somber.
Yeah, I can imagine. But Gerard, do we know what specifically is the health condition that prompted Licata to make this decision?
No, and he was asked by reporters in a short press conference after the announcement, and he wouldn't say, only that he'd known about it for a little bit. He talked to his doctor recently, and the doctor, in Licata's words, gave him some choices, and Licata just mentioned that he wanted to spend more time with his children, as you heard, and then his grandchildren, but he wouldn't go into detail as to what his health issues were.
Right, and he's still a relatively young man, 59 years old. I can say that because I'm 62. But yeah, it was a shock. There's no doubt about it, not just in Broward, but I think throughout South Florida. Kate, tell us about the deputy superintendent, Howard Hepburn, whom the board then selected to replace Licata. Licata considered Hepburn his, quote, go-to deputy, right?
Right. So Dr. Howard Hepburn is a proud son of Belgrade in rural western Palm Beach County, and he came to Broward County with Lakota. They've been described as kind of a package deal.
Right.
So Hepburn grew up in Palm Beach County and then went off to school, got a bachelor's and master's in education at the University of Central Florida, has a doctorate as well in education, and worked his way up through classrooms, public school classrooms in Orange County, Seminole County, and then moved back to Palm Beach as an instructional superintendent, where he met Dr. Lakota, and they developed this relationship. And Lakota has said, you know, the person who has been by his side since then and in Broward has been Hepburn.
Right.
And he told me that he has been preparing Hepburn to be superintendent, but just didn't think it would be so soon.
So soon. But this obviously made it much easier for the board then to select his successor.
Sure, sure. Yeah. That he's been, you know, a known quantity and by Lakota's side in this time.
And here's what Hepburn himself had to say after his selection.
I'm so elated to continue the focus, to continue the priority, to move our school district to an A. I know it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of effort, and it's going to take a lot of collaboration on the part of the public to build that trust back in us.
Kate, I'm struck that Hepburn emphasized, quote, regaining the public's trust in Broward Public Schools. In the brief 10 months Lakota was in the superintendent's job, did he make some strides in regaining that trust after the scandals and controversies that preceded him? I mean, was he able to accomplish, let's say, stuff that Hepburn can now build on? I'm thinking, for example, of the big reform project, the Redefining Our Schools plan.
Right, and that's the big assessment of sort of coming to terms with the extreme declines in enrollment the district has seen over the past two decades and making tough decisions about closing and consolidating schools. Yeah, I think Dr. Lakota, and Hepburn too acknowledges public trust is one of the challenges in Broward mm-hmm. County. Dr. Hepburn has to know that and read the room. But I think there was a lot of hope in Dr. Lakota as someone who could stick around and lead
yeah.
and make these hard decisions, you know, mm-hmm. recognize them and make them. And Dr. Lakota got a lot of credit, certainly from some board members for taking on and leading the redefining effort, which certainly has been fraught at times and
yeah.
absolutely still struggles with distrust, but that he sort of launched this effort and shouldered this, I think,
and did leave a little bit of a positive foundation then for Hepburn to, as I said, build on.
I think so.
In that sense. Gerard, at the meeting that you attended this week, after he announced his retirement, did Lakota address the status of that plan, redefining our schools, that project?
So Lakota himself didn't. After it was voted on by the board that he retire and they bring in Hepburn, they immediately, Hepburn came to the dais and Lakota stepped down, literally.
Right.
There was a presentation. It was a short 12-slide presentation on the redefining project. And it was just 12 slides, like I said, and there were what the district called innovation zones.
Mm-hmm.
So these are zones where elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools are in the same area and can, what the district said, collaborate to serve students, as kind of vague as that sounds. And the board members were a bit upset at how slow the process was going, how uh-huh. vague the presentation was, how little data there was. Staff, including Hepburn, said that there'd be more details coming in June and they would try and make it a very transparent process.
Mm-hmm.
But board members were definitely frustrated at the slow speed that it was going at.
Right. Well, that's important. Kate, is this plan, especially the school closures project that's built into it, is it at risk now of falling behind schedule? And if so, what are the potential consequences?
Yeah, I mean, like Gerard said, there was a lot of frustration, certainly from some board members this week, with what they see as a lack of detail, a lack of comprehensive data for them to make these decisions and to explain them to the public and to bring the public alongside these decisions. And there were moments of, you know, board members questioning staff about, you know, how were these decisions made about these innovation zones? Mm-hmm. And the response was basically, you know, staff couldn't really articulate it because Dr. Licata, you know, they didn't want to speak on his behalf and, right. and he had stepped down.
Right.
So there was sort of a breakdown there in communication.
Right. And this makes his retirement all the more frustrating then, because it just makes follow through on these kinds of things harder. No.
Yeah. There's no good moment for a change in leadership like this, but this is a particularly tough moment. But I will say Licata is staying on in an advisory role.
Right.
They're still negotiating his exit. Mm-hmm. As far as the contract, but he is working with Hepburn to onboard him, you know,
right.
to make this transition, and especially when it comes to redefining.
Right, so technically he's sticking around until the
he
end
is.
Of the year, right? Okay.
Yeah, well, we don't know the exit timeline
oh, okay.
yet, so
right.
he's going to negotiate that next week.
Okay. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Kate Payne and Gerard Albert III about more Broward Public Schools crisis. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gerard, when we talk about the redefining our schools plan and the need to close schools amid steeply declining enrollment, that obviously leads us to the issue of the Broward County Public School District's precarious finances. What were some of the big budget anxieties the board had to address at this week's meeting, or did they at all?
They talked about some of it. You know, there was an exchange between Tori Alston, who's been openly critical of the budget, and the board, the district staff.
Right, and we should mention Tori Alston being one of Governor DeSantis's appointees to the board, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
So a stat that came from staff, in the past 6 years, just to like, I guess, overstate how big of a problem this is, in the past 6 years, the enrollment of the district has gone down by 20,000 students. That's about 10%.
Yeah.
So that is hundreds of millions of dollars in state funding that the schools, the school district is losing.
Yeah.
The other big, item that Mr. Alston was talking about was these teacher raises that came largely from COVID relief money that will not be there next year. So this district is going to have to find more than $20 million for teachers' salaries, and that's only teachers. A big thing that Mr. Alston was talking about mm-hmm. was there's more than 12,000 other employees that did not get raises that he wants to see get raises. So where that money is going to come from is a bit of a mystery right now for the district.
Right, and Kate, let's talk about the other big where's the money gonna come from mm-hmm. issue, this court settlement that is obligating the Broward County Public School District to pay out tens of millions of dollars to charter schools. Let's talk about that court settlement. Briefly remind our listeners how we got to this point, starting with that almost $500 million in Broward County tax referendum money from back in 2018 that the charter schools in the county say they were cheated out of.
Right. So as you said, this dates back to 2018. Voters approved a tax increase to raise money overwhelmingly for traditional public schools. It ultimately raised about $450 million mm-hmm. over 4 years, a fraction of which was shared with charter schools because at the time, district schools did not have to share that referendum money
right.
with charters. Since then, court cases and a new state law have changed that. And so charter schools in Broward brought lawsuits after the money was gone, after that four-year period, alleging that they were owed this money.
Right.
And state officials, the state commissioner of education, have backed them up and,
right.
and pressured Broward to make this
especially education commissioner Manny Diaz.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, but we don't know exactly how much this settlement then requires the district to pay the charter schools, but the charter schools have been asking for $80 million. Do you think it's probably close to that, if not that exact figure?
Yeah, we don't know. The exact amount has not been publicly released yet. Hopefully we'll learn that soon. It sounds like there's still some last minute, negotiations being nailed down. But I think that's that's the expectation, that it's in the ballpark of the state estimate of $80 million.
And $80 million, the board says, puts a pretty big dent in the district's budget?
Certainly, especially as, you know, Gerard was talking about earlier, the $20 million that the board set aside for teacher raises in non-recurring funds for a recurring expense. You know, they were already struggling to find that $20 million for next year, and here we're talking about $80 million over the coming 3 years.
And Gerard, at the Broward School Board meeting this week, Governor DeSantis's board appointees, including Tori Alston, as you mentioned, proposed firing the school's district, the school district attorney, Marilyn Bautista, because of her handling of the charter school's money issue, right?
Right. That proposal came from DeSantis appointee Daniel Fogenholy.
Okay, right.
During the meeting, Fogenholy walked back that proposal, took it off the agenda, because of the announcement from Mr. Licata, Dr. Licata, of his resignation. And he just did not feel it was the right time to have even more turnover.
Is that also the reason why the proposal to rescind this raise for Broward teachers didn't come through as well? I mean, did Dr. Licata's retirement put a damper on those proposals?
I can't say for sure. I mean, and that came from Tori Alston, and in Alston's own words, he thought that he didn't have the support for it. It would have, it could have rescinded some of their raises and try and spread the raise money out to, again, another like 12,000 or so employees. Mm-hmm. He knew he didn't have the support to get it passed, and he withdrew it. But he said he would come back with another plan.
So, Kate, in the end, where does this leave the embattled Broward Public Schools? Has it moved past the earlier controversies, like, for example, the grand jury investigations of school board members from a couple years back? And despite Licata's shocking departure, is the district positioned now to perhaps keep moving forward, or did this week take us a couple steps back?
Well, I don't know if it ever really ends for Broward, I'm afraid to say.
It's beginning to feel that way, yeah.
God bless them. But I think the state scrutiny of the district continues, the tensions on the board continue. We talked about the two members who were appointed by DeSantis and are often opposed on policies that the rest of the board is pushing. Certainly the financial pressures continue. Yeah. This is still a very, very difficult time. But I will say, this week could have gone so much worse for Broward County. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, folks I've talked to have pointed out, you know, they're grateful that this, honestly, the board made a decisive decision here in making this appointment of Hepburn. Mm-hmm. The state board did not, you know, take sanctions against the district in a way they could have.
Although we should also mention that the state said it is going to be watching this payout of money to the charter schools very, very closely.
Yes. So that issue is not done. But I think it's fair to say this week could have been so much worse for Broward. And there are some folks who I talk to who honestly say they're excited and they are hopeful in Dr. Hepburn's leadership. And they hope that he's the one who can really navigate this difficult time.
Well, we will see. Kate Payne is WLRN's education reporter. Gerard Albert III is our Broward County reporter. Thanks, as always, to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, West Palm Beach is turning public spaces into third places. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I was in Italy on vacation a few weeks ago, and one of the things I was reminded of is how important public spaces are, or should be, to places like that. Not just for working out or eating out, but for getting to know people outside our narrow circles of friends and family and coworkers. Maybe it's a chess park or an outdoor plaza for people who like to paint. Spaces that are an antidote to today's tribal and polarized communities, and to the iPhone-driven isolation of our 21st century lives. Those kinds of public spaces are often known as third places, a pleasant, perhaps even mind-opening addition to our homes and jobs. WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilcom Brutus recently discovered that you don't have to go to Europe to find them. He discovered in West Palm Beach, in fact, they're leading a push to create more third places in South Florida. Wilcom Brutus joins me now to talk about what he found. Wilcom, how are you?
Hey, Tim, all is well. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. And to our listeners, do you have a, quote, third place in your life? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Wilcom, tell us about this third place campaign in West Palm Beach and the chess park there you reported on this month and how it embodies what a, quote, third place can and should be.
Yes, Tim, I had a lot of fun reporting on this
story. That was obvious, yeah.
So this two-year-old chess park on Fern Street and Dixie Highway here in West Palm Beach fosters a sort of perky chance encounters with people from all walks of life, different racial and socioeconomic backgrounds, bonding with each other with one specific interest or hobby. And, you know, it's hard to come by because urban sprawl makes it difficult for people to physically connect with each other, and that's quite unhealthy. So The West Palm Beach Downtown Development Authority, which is a special taxing agency known for improving public spaces in the downtown area, they noticed a growing demand from people looking for opportunities to connect in an authentic way, which had skyrocketed during the pandemic.
Aha. Thanks for pointing that out. The pandemic is often such a factor in these developments. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's life, right? We're comparing pre-pandemic versus post-pandemic. And although the program started in 2017, obviously the interest for these public human connections skyrocketed in 2020.
No. That's an excellent point. I'm so glad you brought that up. But why did the West Palm Beach Downtown Development Authority, or DDA, as you mentioned, feel this sort of thing was so important for the city of West Palm Beach and for any city, for that matter?
Sure. It started in 2017. I spoke to Cheryl Moriente. She's the DDA's Public Realm Director, which is a new position that you're seeing crop up across the country. She's basically the first Public Realm Director or Public Realm Czar in West Palm Beach. But she's basically in charge of designing and enhancing these public areas. And she said there's simply a lot more people now than when the program started in 2017. Since then, the number of residents, specifically in the downtown area, had doubled to more than 10,000 people. Uh-huh. Now, the city overall has a population in West Palm Beach of 117,000, but downtown is simply just more densely populated with more opportunities for direct human connection.
And why a chess park for developing that kind of human connection?
Consistency. I think the chess park really started off with a chess player named Joshua Parenti Kaler, who presented the idea to Rafael Clemente. He was the executive director, or is the executive director for the DDA. Mm-hmm. And I think it was initially supposed to be a pop-up. They typically do pop-ups across the county, but this particular chess park was just way too popular, and it became a permanent fixture.
Right. And as your report seemed to indicate, pretty much filled every day, no?
Oh, absolutely. But most of the games are held over the weekend.
Okay. Now, to clarify for our listeners, let's just back up and describe for us, though, Wilcom, what defines a, quote, third place as you presented it in your report? What makes a public space a third place?
One of my favorite words that I like to use, even in my own life, is the word consistency, Tim. Mm-hmm. Consistency in people, time, place, and days make a public space qualify as a third place. Is the public area a permanent fixture? That's also very important. Or at least a physical event that occurs frequently enough where you can still notice the same pattern of human connection, like seeing the same people or remembering people's names, making new friends. For many people, it's church on a Sunday, or when I grew up, it was basketball in the evenings. Uh-huh. For this particular chess park, it's usually on the weekends, and it's a consistent thing.
Right. Now, I want to play a clip from your WLRN report here. It's from your interview with a West Palm Beach resident named Celine Adrian, who's originally from Italy, where, as I mentioned in my introduction to this segment, they take the idea of third places pretty seriously.
She says a third place reminds her of a piazza, a dense public square that's accessible to everyone.
Because the idea of community, as you say, in Italy, it happens in the piazza, which is the public square, which, as you said, is accessible to all. Nobody has to really spend more than maybe a euro for that espresso, but that's it. So it is extremely important to be able to have a place to go where it is not around drinking or spending money or things that are not only consumeristic and materialistic, but sort of obscure the community building of just sharing and chatting and being together.
That was West Palm Beach resident and Italy native Celine Adrian speaking to WLRN's Wilkin Brutus. We have Shane on the line from Hollywood, and he's approaching this topic as a gamer. Shane, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your feelings about third places?
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me. I was just saying that, as somebody who plays a lot of board games and card games and that sort of thing, the Magic the Gathering type stuff, mm-hmm. there's shops you can go to that, people just go hang out, play some games.
Right.
Maybe make some friends. No real pressure. You don't have to spend any money. I mean, you can spend money, and it helps if you have your own gear or decks or whatever, if you're going to go, but you don't have to. You could just go and hang out and be nerdy with a bunch of other nerds,
Right. But you'd like to see that kind of thing developed more into sort of the more outdoor type of third place public spaces that Wilkin's been talking about?
Not as much, but I would definitely like to see more of that kind of idea,
Okay.
Because it is, it's along the lines of the chess club space sort of thing, where people mm-hmm. get together, they casually play their games, they have fun, they get to know each other.
Right.
Same principle, just different game.
Right. It can be any kind of activity too. I mean, like I mentioned in my introduction, painters, for example, I think it would be a great place for people to get together and share art, that kind of thing. Shane, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with our Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, about the push for public spaces known as third places. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Wilkin, let's go back to what Celine Adrian was just saying there before in that clip. Are folks like the West Palm Beach Downtown Development Authority using places like Italy as a reference point for how to create third place public spaces, or are we sort of creating our own American versions of the idea?
Right. First of all, I want to echo what that caller said
sure.
about the importance of low barrier of entry places where you don't have to spend that much money. I really love that caller's enthusiasm. Maybe we should just create like a frolicking group. Go to parks.
Right.
Just frolic around, Tim. You can join us. But I met Celine by sheer happenstance. She had a few of her favorite third places of her own around the city, and the easygoing feel of the Chess Park, in her opinion, felt like home for her.
Right.
And I think we are creating our own American version of the third place because of urban sprawl issues, but also how different cultures view third places varies. And so local urban experts like Cheryl Moriente of the DDA say a campaign to get people out can shift the mindset mm-hmm. to get people out in these public spaces. Early on, she said some folks were just saying it's just too hot outside in Florida, whereas Celine is like, I'm from Italy, we're outside anyway. She was quite confused by the cultural differences in that aspect.
Mm-hmm. But I would think that we already have some models here. For example, Domino Park in Miami's Little Havana down here. Does that kind of fit the criteria that we've been talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said earlier, it's about consistency. In West Palm Beach, for example, we have the West Palm Beach Green Market, which occurs every weekend. We have several independent coffee shops like Pump House and Common Grounds. Common Grounds host open mic events mm-hmm. Where folks can obviously present their talents and meet and congregate afterwards. And so we had a chess player who was also part of my reporting, who initially was playing chess at his local barbershop before finding the chess park.
Ah.
And so you're seeing third places in very unconventional places that you wouldn't expect to be referred to as a third place, such as a barbershop, for example.
Yeah, I was just going to say a barbershop seems to me kind of, you know, fitting into that mold of a third place or a hair salon, you know, in deference to everybody.
Oh, yeah. Yoga, yoga studios, pickleball courts. As long as you're consistently seeing the same people, the
right.
same sort of interest, and the conversations are positive, third places do have a sort of positive connotation behind it. I think the overall goal here is to make sure that we are connecting in a positive way.
Right. Now, when I listened to your report, Wilkin, though, I have to admit I thought of some larger social questions as well. For starters, do people like the DDA in West Palm Beach see this as an antidote, perhaps, to a lot of the antisocial atmosphere we're dealing with in 21st century America, especially our sociopolitical tribalism and polarization these days?
Yeah, so the term, Tim, third place was actually coined by a sociologist, Ray Oldenburg, in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
For him, informal gatherings increased civic engagement. That was one of the purposes for
right.
coining that term. And so the West Palm Beach DDA typically allows the public to make those calls on what to talk about in these spaces. But you typically see more reasonable conversations that that you won't see in these sort of tribalistic online spaces.
Yes.
It's very different.
Yeah. No, again, as I said, an antidote to that kind of social media space that can just get so toxic. Is the feeling that these kinds of third places, as I said before, are an antidote to that toxic, ambiance that we so often run into in our social media world today?
Absolutely. I think directly and indirectly, to some extent, the pandemic really increased those toxicity or
yeah.
behind some of those conversations with all of the disinformation
right.
and misinformation regarding the virus.
Mm-hmm.
But simultaneously, people were yearning for human connection. It was the great irony. And I think the DDA did a great job at pointing out that particular demand and creating an action plan that would allow the community to also establish their own community to help these third places grow on their own and not just have a government entity produce these third places. So they allowed it to happen and then allowed a community to take control.
Right.
Of it.
One of the things that struck me in your report was how some of the people said that they take it upon themselves to do the maintenance for that chess park in West Palm Beach. They're not waiting for the city to come in and do things like cleaning the place up.
Absolutely. Celine, when I approached her, she was literally picking up trash and putting it in the garbage can. Her two
yeah.
boys were running around, one of whom was actually playing chess with the adults. And so we typically think third places are just for adults, but kids
mm-hmm.
can also use third places as a way to enhance their mental capacity. I mean, when we were growing up, the parks,
mm-hmm.
The playgrounds are third places for children. And in Celine's perspective, children can learn the type of wisdom that they need to learn from adults in these specific third places. So to see a 9-year-old
right.
Play chess against adults was also fascinating to see. It's something you just don't see often.
Now, we mentioned the pandemic. You mentioned that this third place term was coined by a sociologist. Is this also considered a potential remedy for the social isolation sociologists say so many folks fall into today as we sit there thumbing our smartphone keyboards all day? I'm thinking especially of the crisis experts keep pointing out regarding the inability of American men today to form friendships. The chess park you reported on in West Palm Beach, does that seem to speak to that problem?
Absolutely. Obviously, chess still has a lot more work to do in terms of representation, bringing in more women to the fold. But the chess park, I mean, you could tell by the pictures that I took, was dominated by men. And to that extent, yes, it's still extremely important. Chess player Joshua Parente-Kaler is the one, again, who convinced the executive director from the West Palm Beach DDA to help launch the chess park.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the weekly chess matches had quickly turned into a 200-plus social member club that spawned into a separate nonprofit that keeps these human connections going.
Right.
200-plus people on a WhatsApp group. And I'm part of that group, and I've seen how often they've kept each other updated on
right.
chess matches and chess dates. And right. so it is forming this authentic coalition of male friends who are finding more healthier mm-hmm. ways to express themselves.
Well, let's see how this develops in the future then. Great reporting, Wilken. Wilken Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilken, thanks as always.
Tim, thank you.
Still to come, the U.S. retightens the sanction screws on Venezuela, but Venezuelan anxiety here is high. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Back in October, the Biden administration lifted a good chunk of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's vital oil industry. That's because, at the time, authoritarian Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro had agreed, at talks in Barbados, to hold a free and fair presidential election this year. Well, since then, Maduro has brazenly backed out of that deal, mainly by barring popular opposition candidate Maria Corina Machado from running, because, say critics, polls show she would defeat Maduro by a landslide. As a result, President Biden had little choice this week but to reimpose those U.S. oil sanctions on Venezuela. But either way, it's doubtful Maduro will suddenly change his mind and hold a transparent election on July 28th, or that an opposition candidate who could be chosen this weekend to replace Machado will have any fair shot. Meanwhile, Venezuelan expats here in South Florida and around the world are beginning to doubt whether they'll have any shot at actually voting in that election. What do you think of the U.S. retightening the sanction screws on Venezuela? Are you an expat hoping to vote in July? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Miami business consultant and Venezuelan exile activist Beatriz Olavarria, who over the years has led efforts to help Venezuelans abroad vote in elections back in Venezuela. Beatriz, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me and giving me the opportunity.
Well, let's start with the sanctions the Biden administration decided it had to restore on Venezuela's oil industry this week, Beatriz. Why in the end did Biden have no choice but to slap those sanctions on the Maduro regime again?
Well, because obviously the Maduro regime has not kept the promise or the word in the Barbados, agreement,
mm-hmm.
Barbados agreement. And obviously, you know, he has already, you know, more prisoners, you know, they come in and out. And now there are more prisoners than before, because they always have like a stash of that.
Right. And, I mean, we should point out that just recently he arrested the top aides of that popular opposition candidate, Maria Corina Machado. And now they're having to go into exile, what, in Argentina?
Well, there are right now they are safe in the Argentinian embassy, but they have not given them the passage, the safe passage agreement, which mm-hmm. were they had said that they were going to give them to them. And they decided to not do it the day they had offered mm-hmm. to give it in.
OK,
so, yeah. They're still in Venezuela, but at the safeguard of the Argentinian embassy.
Right. So because of that sort of thing, the Biden mm-hmm. administration just decided, no, we've got to slap these sanctions back on Maduro. We just can't let this sort of thing go unanswered.
Well, it did have a date. So
right.
they did release this Alex Saab, which was a very important prisoner. And they lifted the sanctions. And as of today, I think the regime has gotten much more fierce. They've come up with these, laws to quiet everybody, fascist law, whatever law that
right.
there is, so that they can put people, you know.
Right. You're referring to the anti-fascism law they just passed, which essentially would jail anybody who even criticizes the Maduro regime.
Well,
And I should point out, you mentioned Alex Saab. When you say a prisoner, he was a prisoner who was here in jail in the United States on money laundering charges. And then under this deal, he was brought back to Venezuela.
Yes.
But yes. I think
the sanctions, yeah. So the sanctions, obviously, they had to lift him. But I understand that they have lifted. They have lifted one sanction.
Yeah.
Which is the L4 one, which is the lighter version of the petty cash of 45 million monthly that goes into PDVSA, which is the petty cash of the regime.
Right.
And they have not lifted the license 41 Chevron, which provides around 170 million monthly.
What they reimposed was, they rescinded the license that was allowing U.S.-linked companies to engage and do business with the Venezuelan oil industry, and which also allowed the Venezuelan oil industry to sell its oil on the world market in U.S. dollars, which it now can no longer do. But I think a big question also, Beatrice, is at this point, will the sanctions really have any effect in terms of getting Maduro to reconsider his betrayal of the Barbados Agreement and allow a democratic presidential election in July?
I understand that the Biden administration gave an explanation on why they had not lifted the license 41 of Chevron, is because they wanted to keep conversations going until the last day, I would presume, because that is a license that goes monthly.
Right.
So, let's be patient.
Okay.
Hopefully that works. Who knows? I don't think so, but hey.
But is Maduro's brutal crackdown on Venezuela's political opposition a sign of just how afraid he is of Maria Corina Machado, especially after she won more than 90% of the vote in last fall's opposition presidential primary, which, of course, Venezuelan expats here voted in? I mean, polls show Maduro's approval rating in Venezuela at about 20% right now, no?
Mm-hmm. 20. Yeah, I don't think it even gets there.
Yeah.
There are recent polls that it doesn't even get there. And I think that what mostly worries the other countries, or and the U.S. included, is the ginormous migration that will probably come out if these elections don't go the way they should go.
Right. According
Maduro
to polls
in the regime,
according to recent polls, 40% said that if Maduro holds this, quote, fraudulent election and wins again, they say they're going to leave the country. No,
absolutely. And we already have 8.7 million Venezuelans migrated 27% of the population
over the past decade. Venezuela has lost about almost a fifth or a quarter of its population because of this humanitarian crisis, which is the worst in modern South American history. Maduro, we should also mention, not only block Machado from running in the election, but also the replacement that she selected to take her place. He wouldn't even let her register either, right?
Absolutely. And they are in those conversations today. And I understand, I just actually read it, that they will meet tomorrow. The PUD, which is the Plataforma Unitaria, with Maria Corina and Manuel Rosales, who
that's the opposition
successfully.
The opposition coalition, yes.
Mm-hmm. Coalition, yeah, yeah.
And they're going to be meeting this weekend, and one of the purposes would be then to select an opposition candidate to go ahead and run in that July 28th presidential election against Maduro, right?
Yes, yes. The thing is that, obviously, Maria Corina has very clearly stated more than once that she was given a mandate and that she feels responsible for that mandate, and that she will go through that mandate, and that she wants free and fair elections. And obviously she is the leader. I mean, it was just 90 something percentage of votes she got. So she has the right to choose someone, and she did it. Mm-hmm. Actually, that was a very great move, because the lady she chose is, you know, a standard of highness too.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even that didn't work. But as you can hear, it kind of worked, because there you can see Lula saying some things and Petro saying some other things, you know.
You're referring to the presidents of Brazil and Colombia, yeah.
Exactly, yes.
But
But
Beatrice, a lot of experts, though, who I should say Venezuela experts, who've been watching, you know, this crisis for years, a lot of them seem to be saying that it's important for the opposition to at least participate in the election, even if it is a fraudulent farce. Do you agree with that, that the opposition at least taking part in it and being visible in it is important?
Well, as of now, those who are registered, let's exclude Manuel Rosales, because that is to see, you know, if it changes or not. The regime says that they have 12 parties of opposition, and that's not really the reality.
Right. These opposition candidates that are on the ballot are really not, quote, opposition. They're sort of,
absolutely,
I don't want to call them puppets, but they're kind of candidates that the regime can rely on to not be much of a threat.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So, no, I mean, not only not much of a threat, they actually help the whole thing, because when they are available to do this, you know, monopoly kind of a board, which is something that they need to do in order to really get legitimized, right?
Right.
The regime has to do that to do, you know, the farce of, you know, we are competitive.
Right.
And I think that's just playing foul play. Yeah.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm speaking with Venezuelan exile activist Beatriz Olavarria about the U.S. reimposing oil sanctions on Venezuela and the declining prospects for a fair presidential election there this year. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Beatriz, let's pivot from Venezuela to the Venezuelan diaspora. You have done a lot of work over the years helping Venezuelan expats vote in Venezuelan elections. Because the regime closed down its consulate here in Miami, for example, you've organized in the past successful expat voting missions to cities like New Orleans. But now the Venezuelan regime seems to have found ways to make it more difficult than ever for expats to vote. How is the regime doing that for this presidential election that's coming up in July?
Well, I'm telling you, there were even people that were doing protests by not eating, you know, hunger strikes in Spain. They gave, it was so predictable, they gave like a four-week, a month to right in the middle of, we can call it here, spring break, but in Latin America, it's Holy Week.
Semana Santa, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that week, obviously, they didn't open. Even after that week, they didn't have instructions from Venezuela. They even put things outside because people were coming in and out. They decided to ask for illegal, but because that's completely out of the constitution. You had to have valid passports.
Passports, right.
And I mean, seriously, all you needed was your ID from Venezuela, the cédula identidad.
Right.
And some kind of legality. In my days, 2000, when we were trying to pull people to register, all you needed was a bill from your T-Mobile, whatever, your phone or electricity to show that you live
just
in that
to prove
city.
To prove residence, right?
To prove residence. Nowadays, they not only that, because every country, Colombia has a diversity of legal temporary that are 3 years, 4 years. Well, they did not accept any of those. You had to either, let's say, have a green card or be of that country.
Right.
So it's when you, I'm just going to give you a number. The registry in the world of Venezuelans, I'm in it because I did it a long time ago, is 107,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give you a little note here. In 2018, when Maduro had his election, we were only 101, like the Dalmatians. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
And we were only 100, which was
That's
precarious
much,
for
much,
the amount of Venezuela.
Much, much lower number, right? Unfortunately, exactly. Beatriz, for time, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much.
Yeah.
Beatriz Olavarria is a Miami business consultant and Venezuelan exile activist. Beatriz, many thanks.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, postal poetry. Your odes to your zip codes. WLRN has partnered again this year with the O Miami Poetry Festival, inviting you to write an ode to your zip code during April, which is National Poetry Month. The rules are simple. Use your 5-digit zip code to write a 5-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line. Here's one example of how it works.
Hello, I am Neshma Jones. I live in Miami, and this zip ode is dedicated to my grandparents in Broward. 33323. Jamaica, them from. Jamaica, they left. Jamaica, they love. But built new Jamaica here.
WLRN has even built a zip ode tool to help you at wlrn.org/zipodes. Here's another smart offering to carry you into the weekend.
My name is Fabian Robaina. I live in Miami Lakes. I chose 33014, and my zip ode is swam 90 miles, forgot my home, salty, just like my opinion.
The Zip Ode's finale community reading will take place at Biscaya Museum and Gardens on Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. For more information, visit omiami.org. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Kata Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.